Okay, so we kind of start with greater earnestness now to deal with stars. I picked out one group of three. Usually call this the big arc. So the plan is to point at a dot and give me the name of that dot, give me the spectral type. I'm thinking that somebody else is going to come. So there are three dots in here you should know the name and spectral type of. So point at three stars in the big arc and report their spectral types. Three stars, name, spectral types, point at them. Spectral types, three stars, arrows, names, spectral types, your name, 2 minutes. So, There are three dots on this piece of paper that you should recognize. Point at those dots, name those dots, and report the spectral type of those dots. Anyone else not have one of these guys? Big sheet from last time. Okay, why don't you send them this away? If you're still working on them, that's fine too. So that's old, yes. Right? This is the pile. Yep. Did I get yours, Joe?
Yep. You get much from me today, though.
Guessing doesn't usually help a whole lot for this one. So The plan is, of course, to do this for a 10-point question on the exam, which is in a little bit more than a week. And almost certainly it'll be the winner hex, because that's got kind of the most stars in it. And that's what we'll do next for an in-class one. So same story, dots and lines, point at. I think there are 8 stars in the winner hexagon. So for, I don't know, something like 30 points or something like that of quiz stuff.
Did you say something about the summer triangle on these? Because for some reason I was under the impression that
today. So what I said was it was going to be a group of 3 stars, and there are 2 groups of 3 stars. There's this one, and there's the summer triangle. So it was an either or. Other questions? So like usual, there's a lot of stuff crammed in before Thanksgiving. Night lab next week, home labs are due before Thanksgiving. On to the next chapter. So it goes. Okay, so we were kind of finishing up star birth and starting the lives of stars. And before we really got underway, we talked about dust. So dust is a perennial problem for astronomers. It changes the light we get from the stars, and so it often screws up our measurements. So in the long history of mistakes in astronomy, dust plays kind of the leading role. So dust are tiny interstellar grains, probably mostly made out of carbon, maybe ice on top of that carbon. And they are particularly present in cold, dense gas regions like the giant molecular clouds. And they particularly affect short wavelength light. So we have a hard time seeing inside the giant molecular clouds with visible light because of this dust. We'd be better off with an infrared telescope, best yet with a radio telescope. Because the light of the blue light will be particularly absorbed, letting the red light through, so stars will look extra red. We might misinterpret that to mean that the star is cooler, and it'll also dim the light, so we might interpret that the star is further away than it is. And you might keep in mind sunsets and the blue sky, because it's the same story. When you look at the sun through a lot of the Earth's atmosphere, it doesn't look as white as it does normally. It looks red, or at least orange. And you don't have to worry about burning out your eyes looking at that, because the sun has been dimmed a whole lot because it's gone through that dust. So extinction and reddening are those phenomena. The kind of reverse phenomena is we currently, directly overhead, the sun is shining through that piece of the atmosphere, and some of the light, the blue light in particular, is being scattered towards our eyes. So illuminated atmosphere has a tendency to look blue. So that's the cause of the blue skies. So it's all the same story, caused by scattering and absorption by little things suspended in space. So the story of star formation was that we start with the densest thing we know about, which are giant molecular clouds. Thousands of atoms per cubic centimeter may sound like a lot, but it would be called a vacuum compared to the Earth's atmosphere. And we have kind of a positive feedback situation. If for some reason there's a little bit of extra dense material, then it's going to have an extra strong gravitational pull, and it'll add material to it. That extra material will draw more material to it. So if we start with a little bit of extra mass, it'll accumulate more mass and more mass and more mass, and we can have a collapse to a protostar. And the picture you should have of a protostar is this sort of picture, where we have an accretion disk of material that is mostly going around but is slowly working its way in towards the central object, the protostar. And for reasons we don't exactly understand, stuff is puffed off along the poles at high speeds. And this turns out to be a general phenomena when we have stuff accreting onto a central object. You should keep in mind the ice skater effect. This thing started as something that had a random speed and was 10 light years in size, and as it's collapsed, it's going to automatically spin itself forward. We see these sort of protostars as T Tauri stars sitting above the main sequence on the HR diagram. And again, you should keep in mind the paths of these protostars on the HR diagram. They start as big, cool objects, and they collapse. a general statement that we'll talk about lots of times is the more massive stars, everything happens faster. So maybe 100 million years for a low mass star, but only 100,000 years or so for a high mass star in order to go through this this process. For a star like the Sun, starts very big, very cool, collapses to smaller radius, and then kind of goes up, that is to say, increases its surface temperature, increases its radius a little bit to join the main sequence. Right, so in general, everything goes faster for the more massive stars. They have shorter lifetimes on the main sequence, they collapse faster, they die faster. You can kind of think about gravity pushing the process along. So a low mass star has no big push, you know, it kind of dawdles its way through life. The more massive stars go through life really quickly and burn out really quickly. The original overdensity, one way it could come about is just by random chance. Another possibility is a nearby supernova could snowplow together parts of the giant molecular cloud and cause the original overdensity that leads to the formation of the star. And there's some moderately good evidence that suggests that that's how the Sun formed. But either way, we think that this whole cloud is going to collapse to a sequence of stars, to a cluster of stars, an open cluster of stars. Over time, stars will leave that cluster kind of by random, getting enough speed to have an escape velocity, so we call that evaporation. So we end up with field stars. So presumably the Sun was born in a cluster of stars and escaped 3 billion years ago and is now an isolated star. We don't see any sign of partners to the Sun. Questions on star birth? So, yeah, I could say a long story about that. So, a little bit of that long story would be that it looks like different environments lead to different distributions of masses. But we still couldn't say, you know, looking at some spot in the sky and say that's going to become a high mass star and this other spot's going to become a low mass star. But it looks like, you know, kind of like you might argue that small people are going to be born in China and big people are going to be born in, you know, Nova Scotia or someplace like that. But there'd be big people in China, obviously, basketball players, and there'd be small people in Nova Scotia. Just kind of a shift in the overall distribution of the stars. The other thing that's maybe worth saying is that currently we think that stars, in order to be a star, you have to have a mass between a tenth of a solar mass and 100 times the mass of the Sun. On the low mass end, what's going on is the star never gets hot enough to turn on thermonuclear reactions. On the high end, we think what's happening is basically the strong stellar winds and the huge light output from such a bright star blows off the material before it can accumulate any more than about 100 times the mass of the Sun. And we think that earlier in the universe, the process that allows that wasn't so active. So that early in the universe, there might have been stars that had 1,000 times the mass of the Sun, but not currently. So looking at a particular object, a protostar would be really hard to guess whether it's going to grow, accumulate to 100 solar masses or quit at a tenth of a mass. Some kind of statistical evidence, you could say, but not. And people, it's kind of an active area of research to look at various environments and try and look at the distribution of stars that are produced and try and figure out why, but nothing currently. And I guess the main thing I should stress again is that the big stars are unusual. Almost all stars are smaller than the Sun. So the usual stars are stars that have a mass of maybe half of the mass of the Sun. And everyone else is an anomaly. You know, a giant in kind of the worst sense of the word. So it's going to be kind of hard to figure out why those unusual stars are born in the first place. Currently, stars are forming in our galaxy at the rate of, I don't know, 1 or 10 stars per year. And we don't see them turn on at that rate, right? As I said, this process takes so long that we're never going to see, aim our telescopes and see nothing, and aim our telescopes tomorrow and see a bright dot. Well, I shouldn't say we do see that, but we don't think that's because the star was born. We think that it became unobscured at that point. So star formation seems to be ongoing currently. Kind of not surprisingly, it was more vigorous in the past, maybe 10 times the current rate, 10 billion years ago. But it's still going on today, in our galaxy at least, not in all galaxies. So our sun was born, you know, a good bit into the history of the universe. So presumably there are stars more like our sun that are billions of years older and billions of years younger.
So Earth is about like 5 billion years old.
Close enough.
How old is the universe?
13.7. Yeah, so you can see that the sun was born a good bit into the history of the universe, but not right at the start and not right at the end. So in a lot of regards, we have a tendency to think of the sun as being, you know, kind of typical. And that's not a bad starting point, but do recognize that actually even more typical would be smaller and longer lived than the sun. The sun is a little bit unusual in being as big as it is. More questions? Okay, so then we kind of go on to try and figure out the life history of stars. And we've met lots of these things before. The Virial theorem, which says that if you're made of normal gas and held together by gravity, then if you lose energy, the temperature is going to increase. That's what causes the protostars to turn on in the first place, right? They are shining initially, but they're not producing any thermonuclear energy at their core. As they're losing energy, they have to be getting hotter, and eventually they'll reach the situation, the temperatures and densities at the core that are necessary in order to burn hydrogen to helium. And we know that there are lots of stuff we can burn beyond hydrogen, right? So the first thing you can do is take the smallest nucleus, hydrogen, and build it up into the next smallest element, helium. But there's a long way to go that you can get energy, all the way to iron. So iron is the most stable stuff. You can't burn iron in any sense. So hydrogen fusion, as is going on in the sun, is kind of the first step. We've got the Russell-Voigt theorem, which says if you tell me the mass and the composition, I can tell you everything about that star. And we've had for a while the idea of a normal gas, and so there has to be an abnormal gas. And the name for an abnormal gas is a degenerate gas. And degeneracy is favored by being dense and cool. And technically speaking, here's the definition of degeneracy. It turns out that for the atoms in this room, they're flying around freely with a wide range of energies. In a dense gas, all of the energy levels, all of the low energy levels are filled, so that we have kind of the minimum amount of kinetic energy. And it may seem crazy to call these temperatures, which, you know, here might be 100 million degrees, cool, but they're cool compared to other sorts of temperatures. Okay, so remembering what we said about the Virial theorem in the past, you know, this is kind of the danger zone, right, where we have degenerate gas. Something like this could potentially explode. As long as we're normal gas, we're not going to explode. Questions? So, you know, kind of the overall plan is to put together the life story of stars from three different perspectives. So, this is the perspective that we can most easily measure because it has to do with what's happening to the outside of the star. So, we have the outside surface temperature and we have the total luminosity. And we have various possibilities. So this turns out to be the life history of the sun, which we're going to be working our way to talking about. And it's important to remember that while this is the easiest thing to measure, this is kind of the least connected to what's going on, right? The atmosphere of the sun is nearly nothing, and it can expand and contract, you know, with pretty much ease, independent of what's going on in the core. So much kind of easier to understand is what's going on in the core, and that's what's on the back of those big sheets. We have this sort of diagram. So this is a graph of the temperature versus the density in kind of funny units. So this is 10 million degrees, this is 100 million degrees, this is a billion degrees. That is to say, this is the exponent of 10 that we have for the temperature. 10 to the ninth is a billion. Right, so you remember that the sun is about 15 million degrees, density about 10 times that of lead, so it's sitting about here currently, burning hydrogen to helium. So the same thing applies to this scale. This is 100 times the density of water, this is 10,000 times the density of water, this is a million times the density of water, and so it goes. So we're talking about incredibly dense stuff when we're way over here. And what we know, of course, is that in order to get things to react, they have to come together, and bigger nuclei have greater positive charges, right? So helium has two protons in it, so it's going to be way repulsed. It's going to be hard to push helium nuclei together. So in order to burn helium, it's going to take higher temperatures and higher densities. Carbon has even more protons in its nucleus, so it's even harder to push together carbon. And so it goes. So we have kind of this automatic system, which is, you know, basically a good one. The most common stuff is hydrogen, and it's also the easiest stuff to burn. The second most common thing is helium, and it's the second most easiest thing to burn. And as we go down the periodic table, it takes higher and higher temperatures in order to burn them, and of course we have no option of burning anything that's more massive than iron. Okay, and on the other side of this piece of paper, we've got this sort of diagram. I don't particularly need to get this right, I guess. And this sort of diagram can be very discouraging because the change in size of stars is huge, right? The stars have a radius that's 1,000 times the radius of the sun, and they also have a radius that's 1/100 the size of the sun. So you can't put those things on the same sheet of paper. So what this has done is it's always drawn the same circle for the size of the star, and you have to kind of put together from the HR diagram that such a circle is either going to be big or small depending if it's way up in this corner or not. Okay, so got these three different ways of thinking about stars. This is what the surface is doing. It's kind of the least obvious thing. It kind of can do crazy things. We have what's happening in the core, and what's happening in the core is the easiest to explain, and in fact we talked about this last time, I'll repeat myself again in a second. And we have these cross sections. Okay, so I'll leave this one up here and I'll talk about, because that's the one that you don't have, you have a copy of this in your book. The other ones you have copies with on hand. So let's talk about this diagram to start with. What's easy to understand about this diagram is that the virial theorem says that as soon as you run out of hydrogen, you're going to be losing energy from your surface. And if you're losing energy, you're going to be getting higher temperatures and more compact, higher densities. So automatically, stars should be moving, roughly speaking, like that over time on that diagram. And you can see that that's pretty much the case. All the stars are, generally speaking, going this way. Things get interesting when we cross this degeneracy line, right? Because then we have the possibility of explosion, and we also have the possibility of cooling off, right? Because while gases have these properties, most materials we're used to don't, and in particular, degenerate material doesn't, right? Degenerate material will cool off if it loses energy. So over here we have the possibility of death, that is to say cooling off and getting less and less interesting, and also explosion. Both of those things are possible over here. Here, we should just be getting hotter and denser with time. Okay.
So, on the virial side of things, at some point, do all stars go to degenerate?
No. So, a lot of stars, I use that word a lot. So let me back up and comment that the low mass stars, none of them have died yet. They're still sitting there on the main sequence, quietly churning away, and they're going to last for billions of years into the future. So the stars that are more massive than the sun, lots of those have died in often in explosive ways, but sometimes they've died by going into a degenerate state and just cooling off. And that's exactly what we're going to be outlining. What is the future of those stars? And it's got to be either, I mean, the only ways you can kind of die, if you think about it, is to either explode and totally deconstruct, or to end up as an ember. And the only way you can be a cooling off ember is if you're in the degenerate region. So those are the only two possibilities. And of course, they're both are going to occur at pretty much the same place, right? If we have a star exploding, it's going to do it over here too. More questions? Let's take, before we go down that road, let's take a second and look at more in detail at these reactions that are going on in order to power the sun. So we know that the sun works on the proton-proton chain, where roughly speaking what happens is four protons come together to form helium, and they give off two antimatter electrons and a neutrino in part of this process. Now, it turns out that stars that are a little bit hotter than the sun, although they do the same process net-net, they're turning protons into helium, they do it in a different way than the way that we described for the sun. So remember, for the sun, the thing started with two protons getting together to form deuterium and an antimatter electron and a neutrino. But in stars that are slightly hotter than the sun, it turns out there's another way of going, but it requires the existence of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. And instead of having the first, and you remember that this is the hard step, right? It's very unlikely for a proton to turn into a neutron just in time to be stuck to the other proton. So in more massive stars, it turns out we have what's called the CNO cycle, sometimes the CNO bicycle. And it starts with a proton hitting carbon 12. And if a proton hits carbon 12, it's going to have, we're going to produce a nucleus that has 13 things in it, and it's going to move one slot over on the periodic table, so it's going to be nitrogen 13. And it turns out that nitrogen 13 is unstable. It will spontaneously decay into an antimatter electron and a neutrino, and so it'll lose a proton from the nucleus and it'll end up as carbon 13. Carbon 13 can eat a proton, and if it does that, it's going to become nitrogen 14. And nitrogen 14 is exactly like the nitrogen in the air in this room. It's perfectly stable, so nothing's going to happen to it. But it can eat a proton, and it can become oxygen 15. And oxygen 15 is unstable. Yep. So it's going to decay into an antimatter electron and neutrino into nitrogen 15. And here's where the cycle comes in. Nitrogen 15 is going to eat a proton, but it's going to spit out an alpha particle. And in the process, it's going to come back to carbon 12. So carbon 12 isn't used up in this thing. It's acting as a catalyst that allows the same net reaction to go. If you count up what went in, four protons went in and a helium came out, and we had two of those positron and neutrino pairs. So this happens at higher temperatures because it's hard to push a proton into a nucleus that has six protons, right? They're going to be repulsed by each other. So that extra repulsion requires extra temperature, but once we can get this reaction going, it's more likely to occur than this very rare possibility that the proton turns into a neutron while it happens to be near another proton. Okay, so stars like Sirius that are a little bit more massive than the sun, they turn out to get most of their energy from the CNO cycle, in contrast to the sun, which gets most of its energy from the proton-proton chain. Okay, so much for the very first step that you could make. The next step that you could make would be helium burning. So what we're going to have then is two heliums, which are alpha particles, getting together. And if we just count up what we should have, this guy has two protons and neutrons, this guy has two protons and two neutrons, so we should end up with something that has eight total things in it. And if we look at the chemical chart, it should be beryllium. But it turns out that beryllium is extremely unstable. It doesn't hold together for more than a billionth of a second before it breaks apart into two alpha particles. So we didn't get very far by this reaction. So in order to have a stable reaction that involves helium burning, it turns out that what has to happen is for the billionth of a second that this thing is sitting around, it has to be hit by another alpha particle. And the result then, if you just add things up, turns out to be carbon-12. So this is called the triple alpha reaction. And the net result is that three alphas come together to form garden variety carbon, which is carbon-12. So it's very important that both of the two common ways, both of the two ways you can react, the most common constituents of the universe have problems, have bottlenecks. The bottleneck for reacting protons is this very unlikely possibility that a proton turns into a neutron. Remember, this reaction had a probability that it would take something like 10 billion years to occur. And this guy has the very unlikely possibility for basically a three-particle reaction. For the very short time that beryllium exists, we have to hit it with another alpha particle. So it's only going to happen under very dense conditions, so that it's very likely for an alpha to hit the beryllium. And of course, we need high temperatures to start with in order to push together things that are being repulsed by each other. Well, so what comes next? You notice that carbon burning is listed on the list as another possibility. So we can have two carbons come together, and it turns out that most commonly they form neon, and they spit out an alpha particle. But pretty much at the same time, we can have neon burning, which breaks apart the neon into oxygen 16. And at higher temperatures still, we can have two oxygens coming together to form silicon and lots of other stuff. You might guess that the reactions become more and more possibilities for outcome as we have more and more nucleons, and they can rearrange themselves and spit out various components. So we get more of kind of a soup of possibilities as opposed to one sort of possibility for these other sorts of burnings. But the main story, of course, is that we're moving down this ladder, and to push two carbons together is going to take extremely high temperatures and densities in order to get that process to go. So kind of glancing ahead, well, it's actually what we showed, that kind of sleazy animation last time. We're going to end up with stars kind of like this, where we have hydrogen burning to helium, helium burning to carbon, carbon burning to oxygen, oxygen burning to silicon, all the way down to the unburnable stuff, which is iron. Okay, so these are sometimes called onion-shaped stars. And we're getting to, 6 billion degree temperatures here at the core of this iron. And there's not much we can do with iron in terms of getting energy out. Okay, so we've got thermonuclear reactions. To build up higher stuff is going to require higher temperatures. And we actually have kind of a problem that's maybe worth mentioning now, and we won't resolve it until maybe the last week of class. Six billion degrees sounds like a high temperature, But that's small change compared to the Big Bang, right? There are no higher temperatures or densities than existed than during the Big Bang. So why didn't these reactions happen then? Right? So why did the Big Bang leave any crumbs left for us to nibble on, right? So it left this high energy food, hydrogen, left over from this big explosion, which is lucky for us because we're nibbling on that food in the form of sunlight. So why didn't those extraordinary high temperatures and densities in the Big Bang cook everything to iron? So that's a more a problem for future consideration, but it should boggle the mind, at least to start with. The conditions inside stars may seem extreme, but it's nothing compared to the Big Bang. Much higher temperatures, much higher densities. And luckily, stuff was left over. Because if it was all cooked to iron, we would be cooked, right? There'd be nothing left to eat. Okay, so I want you to keep this picture question.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, so what temperature would the Big Bang?
Infinite temperature, right? So theoretically, it was all together at one point with arbitrarily high temperatures. There are some theories that predict that there is a maximum possible temperature, but regardless, you know, we're talking about temperatures that are a million times the temperature inside of stars. So if there is a maximum temperature, which incidentally I don't believe, it's super high, unbelievably high. And at the end of class, we'll be able to trace back the Big Bang to what may seem like incredibly short times, like a nanosecond after the Big Bang. So we can actually recreate things enough in our laboratories to have a pretty good idea about what was going on at incredibly early times. And maybe I should tell you that these problems, they have solutions, right? We know why stuff didn't cook to iron. We're just not going to talk about it today. Questions? Well, I want you to keep in mind that this diagram always, but it can kind of have limited number of sides to pieces of paper. Let's start with this guy, because this is the easy one, and we've already talked about this in part. So what we have here are different star tracks. And again, we're not talking about stars moving, we're just talking about the density and temperature at the center of the star changing. So this is the track that a star like the Sun follows. This is what track like a star like Sirius that weighs twice as much as the Sun follows. 7 times the mass of the Sun, 15 times the mass of the Sun. So maybe the first question is, where are the low mass stars? And in particular, where are the things that are actually brown dwarfs that have a mass that's less than a tenth of the mass of the Sun? So they never get hot enough to burn hydrogen. Well, we know what's going to happen to those. They're kind of off the bottom of this chart. The virial theorem, as long as they're made out of a normal gas, is going to get them going to higher and higher temperatures and more compressed. But they're not going to cross the line that's required to ignite hydrogen burning, right? Because that's what it means to be a star. So they're going to move over to the degenerate region before they have a chance to get to temperatures hot enough to burn hydrogen, and then they can just cool off. Right? So it's only in here that the virial theorem has this crazy stuff that when you cool off, you get hotter. Here you can cool off and really cool off, reduce your temperature. So these brown dwarf stars that are less than a tenth of the mass of the Sun, they never got hot enough to burn hydrogen to helium. And so as a result, they're in this degenerate region. Why didn't they explode? Because they're in this degenerate region. In order to explode, you have to have a spark, right? You have to have temperatures that are high enough to start the reaction. The sugar that sits on your tabletop will burn, but it's not burning. It's not burning because it's not hot enough. You throw a match into that bowl of sugar, it will burn. So these stars would explode if they got hot enough because they're degenerate, but they're not hot enough. They're below the ignition temperature for hydrogen burning. Okay. So let's, instead of talking about a star that is a tenth of the mass of the sun, let's think about a star that's half of the mass of the sun. Those are kind of the most common types of stars. All of the stars like that that have ever been born are still burning. None of them have died. But if we wait long enough, you know, there's only so much fuel and they're going to die. Just not in our lifetime. So what's happening to those? So they are going to, by the Virial theorem, they're going to reach this temperature to start hydrogen burning, but they're going to do it at a very stingy rate. So they're going to go through their fuel in 100 billion years over a long period of time, longer than the current history of the universe. But eventually they will use up that hydrogen fuel, and if they use up their hydrogen fuel, necessarily, as long as they're made out of a normal gas, as long as they're on this side of the degeneracy line, they're going to get hotter and denser. But instead of reaching the temperature that's necessary for the 3-alpha reaction, they're going to become degenerate, and then they can cool off. It hasn't happened yet, but that's how we calculate what would happen to such a star. Okay, so low-mass stars kind of pass right through the main sequence. Stars that are mass of a half of the mass of the sun, they're going to be on the main sequence effectively forever, but not literally forever. They will run out of fuel eventually, and then they'll end up as degenerate objects just cooling off. So how about the sun? So stars like the sun have born and died. We can kind of figure out what happens to them. So as protostars, they get hot enough temperature to burn hydrogen to helium, and this is what they do for 10 billion years. They sit here more or less at this point burning hydrogen to helium. They change a little bit because gradually their internal composition is going from hydrogen rich to helium rich, right? We know the sun was 70% as bright as it was currently 4 billion years ago when it started. But compared to the changes we're talking about, 30% change is nothing. So basically they don't change at all while they're on the main sequence. When it runs out of fuel, it's guaranteed by the Virial theorem, since it's on this side of the degeneracy line, to get hotter and denser. So here it goes, hotter and denser, crosses into the degeneracy region. We don't have to worry about it exploding yet because it hasn't reached the ignition temperature. But it turns out that it does reach the ignition temperature while it's in a degenerate state. So it's going to explode. So this is what's called the helium flash. And in a very short period of time, a good fraction of the helium that's in the sun burns up. But it turns out it's a totally contained explosion. The mass of the sun keeps those products from working their way to the surface. So if you were to watch a star that now had a helium flash, you wouldn't notice anything. Remember that for the sun, it takes on average 1 million years for a photon to work its way out from the core. So it's kind of no surprise that you could have a whole explosion in the core of the sun and not notice it immediately, or in the next day, or in the next month, or in the next year, or in the next 1,000 years. But it turns out something kind of, so what happens to the core is it is heated and it expands. And while a lot of the helium is burned up, not all of the helium is burned up. So after a few seconds, it ends up over here as an expanded and heated core, stably, under the action of the Virial theorem, burning helium to carbon.
So a photon of light takes like 8 minutes or something to get tossed from the sun?
Yeah, so once it reaches the surface of the sun, then it's flying free.
Right, but so the particles we're seeing technically are like...
Yeah, I hesitate to say the particle because this photon is going to bounce around and it's going to become other photons and it's going to, you know, lots of things are going to happen to it. But if it did, certainly some of those photons are going to retain their identity. Maybe a different way, maybe a better way of saying it is on average a photon goes about a centimeter before it's absorbed and scattered by another atom. So it's a terrible random path before it works its way out to the surface. And then 7 minutes and it's at us. So space is transparent and the inside of the sun isn't. That's the difference. Joe?
That just threw a freaking light in there.
So which piece of that is surprising?
The million years.
The million years. The fact that it bounces around for that period of time, even though it's going 186,000 miles a second. I agree.
What is that?
186,000 miles a second. No, that is the speed of light. Yep.
It's just zigzagging.
It's just zigzagging. Yep. It has this drunk walk. On average, it's just going a step, and it wants to get to Chicago. So it's a long set of random steps, many random steps, before it gets out of the state.
A lot of Mars.
Say again?
A lot of Mars is not that before it gets to Chicago.
I hope not. Okay, helium flash. So it's going to sit here and happily burn helium for a while. And the same thing is going to happen. It's going to run out of fuel. When it runs out of fuel, if it's on this side of the degeneracy line, it's going to get hotter and denser. So here's the core of the sun getting hotter and denser. It crosses the degeneracy line, and it turns out that it doesn't reach temperatures necessary to ignite carbon. Instead, it cools off. You can see that these other stars between 7 and 9 times the mass of the sun, they do. After they've used up their helium, they do ignite carbon, and they do it on the degeneracy side, and the best guess is that this does totally disrupt the star. That is to say that in this particular case, the explosion is not contained, and it destroys the star. But even more massive stars go through that in a non-degenerate state. And you know, they're on their way happily to reach this very multi-leveled star that we were talking about a moment ago. Okay, so that's what's going to happen on the inside of the sun. Let's talk about what happens on the outside of the sun. So for the skeptics, everything I've been talking about is based on calculation, right? It's not based on exact measurement. This is at least somewhat based on measurement, so you kind of have to believe this story, even if you don't believe the other story. So here's where the sun is currently. It's burning hydrogen in its core to helium. And when the core gets depleted in hydrogen, there's still virgin hydrogen that's just outside of the core, right? So we're going to end up with a star that has a helium core, but just outside of it, we're going to have hydrogen that's being burned to helium. And here's the rest of the star. So this is called shell burning. And it turns out that what happens anytime we have shell burning is that the star expands hugely, right? This is expansion, and the surface of the star cools. Now, don't get confused. The center of the star is doing, you know, normal sort of stuff. It's always getting hotter and denser. It's the outer part of the sun that's getting cooler and expanding. And so this is one of many cases where we have the outside of the sun doing the opposite of what the inside of the sun is doing. And that really shouldn't surprise you too much because they're separated by huge amounts of distances and effectively in terms of time. And there's nothing really at the surface of the sun anyway. It's good vacuum. And so it can pretty easily change its dimensions and its temperature, whereas what's going on in the core has to be kind of more regular. So while it's doing the shell burning, it's always getting more and more luminous and cooler on the outside. So now it's moved into red giant territory, right? So we've gone from main sequence luminosity class 5 to through the subgiant stage luminosity class 4 to luminosity class 3. So this is a huge star. Best guess is that it probably won't encompass the Earth, but it'll encompass Venus. And some calculations show it encompassing the Earth, if you like it that way. So here's where the helium flash occurs. We're going to be dead long before that anyway. This process, incidentally, of using up all of the hydrogen in the core is going to take about 5 billion years into the future. So almost all of the lifetime, 90% of the lifetime of the sun is going to be spent at this point. And everything else is kind of, you know, going to the hospital repeatedly. It's the short remaining lifespan of the star. So here's the helium flash. And the outside of the sun, you know, so we've turned on a new power source, helium. So surprisingly, what happens is the outside of the sun actually becomes less luminous and hotter. So this is the so-called horizontal branch in here, where we have helium now burning at the core. So here we have helium burning to carbon. We have stuff here that's not burning, that's just helium that's sitting around. Around that, we have a shell of hydrogen burning to helium. I don't know, there are all these diagrams that are simultaneously active. So let's Let me also point at the other side of this piece of paper. All right, so this is the branch of the sun, right? It's a mass that's less than 1.5 times the mass of the sun. And here we have the stage that I was talking about a moment ago, the red giant phase, where we have an inert helium core with a surrounding shell of hydrogen that's burning. And if we go to the next step over, I hope, right here, yeah, upside down. So here we have helium burning to carbon, helium that's just sitting around, and here we have hydrogen that's burning to helium. And it's the same size circle, but we're talking about giant stars compared to the sun. Okay, so we're going to have a repetition of the same stuff. There's only so much helium that we can burn to carbon. So we're going to use up all of the helium at the core, so we're going to end up with a carbon core. Then we're going to have a shell of helium burning to carbon. Then we're going to have helium that's just sitting around. Then we're going to have a shell of hydrogen that's burning to helium. And then we're going to have hydrogen that's just sitting around. So we've got two power sources. We've got a shell source that is hydrogen burning, and we've got a shell source that is helium burning. Double shell burning. And that leads to a return to the giant phase. This is sometimes called the asymptotic giant phase. Okay, now we know at this point the sun is going to not go on to burn carbon. It's going to become an ember. And it does it in kind of a funny way. So it goes through what are called thermal pulses, and it has these, explosions are an overstatement, but sudden increases in luminosity over years that puff off the outer layers of the star. So we end up with the core of the star surrounded by layers of star atmosphere that have now been puffed off. And what happens is this very hot central star is going to be producing, since it's hot, it's going to be producing lots of ultraviolet light. The ultraviolet light will excite the surrounding gas, and we have a planetary nebula. Like the Ring Nebula, where we have illuminated fluorescing gas surrounding a central hot star. So in this case, the central hot star is the ember of the core.
So all the surrounding gas, is it still at pretty high temperature?
Yes. So it would be at like 10, well, it depends what you mean by high. It would be at like 10,000 degrees.
Okay.
So small change compared to the core, which is at billions of degrees,
yeah.
Hotter than the present surface of the sun. And that eventually this gas is going to dissipate and we won't see it anymore. We'll only see the small ember that's left over. And this small ember, the core of the star that's left over and is not burning anything anymore, it's just hot because it was hot. It's made of degenerate material. We'll talk about that in a second. That's what's called a white dwarf. And no surprise, it's a small size of the sun. It's like 1/100th of the current radius of the sun, which is about the size of the Earth. So it's an Earth-sized object with, it's puffed off a good bit of its mass, so maybe it only weighs 6/10 the current mass of the sun. So, you know, on the order of half of the mass of the sun will be puffed off in this spot. So we're going to be left over with something which is, you know, a good fraction, but not 100% of what we started with. Questions? Yeah, so chapter 20, I think it's chapter 21 or 22 that deals with black holes. So in kind of short answer to your question, in order for a star to die, it can totally explode, and we want to talk about that eventually. It could end up as these white dwarfs, which are small, about the size of the Earth, with a good fraction of the mass of the sun, but not 100% of it. It can also end up in what's called a neutron star. And a neutron star is way smaller, about 10 kilometers in diameter. still has a good fraction of the mass of the sun. So we can actually measure the mass of neutron stars, and lots of them that we've measured have a mass of about 1.4 times the mass of the sun. They come from bigger stars, right? We see that the sun is going to end up in the 6/10 mass white dwarf, but larger stars are going to end up as neutron stars, and larger stars than that are going to end up as black holes. Okay? So do remember that larger stars than that are rare, so it's not, black holes aren't going to be nearly as common as stars, but they should be continuously being created by very massive stars. Stop.
I mean, like, you have a black hole, but then does a black hole or stop being a black hole?
So what would, what how is a stop, how is a black hole going?
Okay.
So that's the picture from the movies.
Well, right? Literally sucking, but, you know, it's drawing, pulling things into it.
So is the sun, is it doing that? It has gravity. So a black hole doesn't suck any more than the sun sucks. So if there is material around, the sun might grab it and pull it to it. It actually turns out that stuff is moving away from the sun as opposed to being, for various reasons, the solar one is puffed off as opposed to grabbing material. But if you dropped a rock, it would go towards the sun. And if you dropped a rock, it would go towards a black hole, but in no special or different way than it would for the sun. So chances are black holes are not surrounded by material that is being sucked in, and so they're just sitting around. If there are planets that are left over from this process, they'd still happily be orbiting the black hole. So the picture from movies that black holes are fundamentally different from normal gravity, that's not correct.
Except that they're, like you said, 10 kilometers in diameter.
So that's a neutron star. Black hole would be even smaller than that.
Okay. So basically they're just incredibly dense.
So you can see I'm hesitating. I hesitate to say anything about what's inside of a black hole, because we can't see what's inside of a black hole. But by definition, the escape velocity is more than the velocity of light, so nothing comes out of a black hole,
yeah.
Approximately speaking.
Pretty dense.
Yeah, but even more dense than you're thinking about. So in an ideal case, if we believe the simple theories about black holes, everything in that star is compressed not to the size of my thumb, but to the size of a mathematical point. So not just huge density, not just hugely huge density, but literally infinite density. I don't know if I believe that. There's absolutely no way of testing it, because we're never going to be able to see inside of a black hole. We'll never have information from the inside of a black hole. But that's what the theory says. Everything's at a mathematical point.
Okay, so a black hole is like
Yeah, crushed to something that's smaller than a nuclei of atoms. So when I talk about the radius of a black hole, what I mean is that this close approach distance, that we're never going to know anything, what's going on inside of that distance. But the theories say that what should be happening inside of that distance is everything in a millisecond gets crunched to a mathematical point. It can't literally be true, I think. But A, we're never going to know, and B, that's what the best current theories would say. People would give that as evidence that the best current theories have to be wrong. And I think I would accept that.
Why don't we fly something into them?
Well, so first of all, there isn't anything that's near enough to do that to. So I was just reading in the paper this morning that the Voyager spacecraft, which are the most distant thing that's ever been, is something like 15 billion kilometers from the sun. But that's nothing. That's 14 light hours from the sun. You know, whereas the nearest star is 4 light years from the sun. And the nearest black hole, I mean, we don't know where it is, but it's got to be thousands of light years away. So we're also never going to fly anything. We're never going to see a black hole. We're never going to make one. No, they aren't. It hasn't, we haven't died yet from the production of the mini black holes at CERN. It's been turned on and the world continued.
But they're like super small and disintegrate also.
No, they're never made. No, that's what CERN says. So that was the critics of CERN were afraid we were going to make the mini black holes. But people did the calculations and the destruction of the Earth did not happen when they turned on CERN. We can be reasonably sure of that. There are incidentally a possibility that mostly we've been talking now about stellar-sized black holes, but there's no reason you can't have very small mass black holes. It turns out that we have no reason to suspect that they exist. But if we're going to ever run into a black hole, it will be one of the many varieties. And people occasionally write science fiction stories about what would happen if one got trapped inside the Earth, things like that. But it hasn't happened in 4 billion years, so it's probably not going to happen tomorrow. Questions? Okay, so remember I said you have to have all of this in your head. Right? So you have to have in mind how the future of the sun is going to change. Most of its time burning hydrogen to helium. Uses up the hydrogen in the core, goes into hydrogen shell burning. The helium at the core explodes because we reach the ignition temperature in a degenerate state. But not all of the helium is used up in that explosion. The core expands and we reach a point where we're burning helium stably at the core. That happens in seconds. The outside of the sun slowly responds and we reach helium core burning. So we have a core of helium burning to carbon surrounded by a shell of hydrogen burning to helium. We use up all the helium in the core, and this incidentally doesn't take very long, and we end up with double shell burning, an outer shell of hydrogen burning to helium, an inner shell of helium burning to carbon, an inert carbon core. We never get hot enough to ignite that carbon. And instead what happens is the sun puffs out its outer layers, so we have an outer shell of gas that is being illuminated by the extremely hot core of the sun. So that's a planetary nebula. The gas over time dissipates, incidentally relatively quickly, say 10,000 years, and what we're left with is the ember, the core of the sun, slowly cooling off over billions and billions of years. And these things are known as white dwarfs. So these guys are supported by degeneracy pressure, so-called degeneracy pressure.
So solar
system
is a giant rock.
Yeah, I guess I don't mind the phrase rock.
Well, will white dwarfs continue to cool off?
Yes. Yeah, because it's degenerate, it can cool off, and it will over literally billions of years, it would reach, you know, any cool temperature that you want to name. And some people actually speculate that the rock is in some sense diamond because it's going to be carbon at the core. But yeah, you can if it's diamond, it's not in any useful sense diamond.
When I was in third grade, I was told that the white dwarfs are the hottest and the red giants are the coolest. Are they just talking about surface temperature?
So the white dwarfs are the hottest objects and red giants are the coolest objects. That's what you were told? Yeah, that's certainly a close approximation to the truth. So way out here, these white dwarfs, I mean, it's the core of the star. So we're talking hundreds of thousands, millions of degrees on the so-called surface of this object. So that's way hotter than any other star we've talked about.
Okay.
So neutron stars, you know, they might put up a fight. They also are very compact cores of stars, and they're going to be very hot also. But they're also going to be very, very, very small. And so none of these white dwarfs were detected until something like 18, I can't remember the date, circa 1900, a little bit before 1900. And no neutron star is visible through an optical telescope. So in some sense, in terms of things that you could conceivably see, and in, let me stress that I've never seen a white dwarf with my eye. That's true. It turns out that, well, okay, so I'll tell this story. I think I've already told it. So when we're talking about binary stars, I talked about astrometric binary stars. And one of the first examples of that was Sirius. So Sirius was seen moving in a small circle, but we didn't see what was pushing it around. And it was only when we had better telescopes that we saw the white dwarf that was pushing around Sirius. And that was incredible, because Sirius is a star more massive than the sun. So whatever this little dot was that was very dim, it had to have a mass that was comparable to the sun in order to be pushing around this other star. So Clark's telescopes were the first ones that were able to spot this little dot, which, since it's a binary star, is very close to this very, very bright dot, Sirius. Okay. Well, I got 5 minutes left. Let me talk about kind of another important factoid. And it's more evidence for how stars live and die. So you remember that we said that stars of more mass have shorter lifetimes on the main sequence, shorter lifetimes in every respect. Everything goes faster for a more massive star. They're born faster, they live their lives faster, and they die faster. But in particular, they're on the main sequence a shorter period of time. And we've also said that stars are formed as clusters from giant molecular clouds, more or less at the same time. So if you think about what that means that if we were to, you know, if we could live billions of years, we could spot, you know, new stars that are just on the main sequence from that cluster of stars. And over time, these stars, the hot luminous stars, would die first. And then these stars would die, and then those stars would die, and then those stars would die. So we can get a handle on how old a cluster is by looking at the last star that's still left on the main sequence. Right? If we know what the lifetime of that star is, we know it's about to die, so we know how old the cluster is. So this is called the turnoff point. So here are data from various clusters of stars. So the Pleiades, you've looked at those with your binoculars, that has to be a fairly young cluster because it still has B-type stars in it. The very bright stars we see with our naked eye, those are actually type B stars, massive stars that don't live very long. So on the list of things to look at was the open cluster HN Chi Perseus. And that has to be even a younger cluster of stars because it retains more and more of these massive stars. On the other hand, M67, which is something we commonly look at in the spring, its turnoff point is at a point that isn't that much different from the sun. So it has to be a much older cluster. So we can kind of age a cluster of stars based on where the main sequence ends. And of course, here's M11, for example. Here we have the giant stars, which have moved from this end to that end to populate this piece of the giant branch. Okay, so stars are born in clusters, and from what's left of the main sequence, we can age that cluster. We can figure out when that star was born. And that gives us some handle on how long it takes to go through all of these processes, because we can look at clusters that have different ages, and we can see how they have different properties and different stars in them. I got 2 minutes left. Can I use it for any useful purpose? Questions? Any questions? So what we have left to talk about, we talked about the sun and what its life history is. We want to talk about, and we've also talked about the life history of low mass stars, right? They have even duller life histories. They live basically forever and then they become white dwarfs without any of this interesting stuff in between. So what we need to talk about more next time is the life history of more massive stars. And of course, you already know the answer. Everything's going to happen faster for those. Okay, we'll quit.